그 누운 성가를 든 스스돌아가 가슴에 아휘를 클랜 내 이래 아후다 그슬 향해 내 포사 마야른 시 스케디아리쉬 내 가슴에 이스라엘 시티 Roig mo Christ a varig me Is iod sy'n tegno bos for me Le mwri na adrysio Mwri na adrysio Si roig mo Christ a varig me Is iod sy'n tegno bos for me Le mwri na adrysio
Listen to KRFP 92.5, Moscow, KRFP Moscow, home to Moscow's community radio station. This is a Wild Clearwater Country show. We have an interesting show for you this week. We have Bill Bonney in the in the studio with us, resident up on Moscow Mountain, concerned about the Naylor Farms proposal on water. So we're going to be dedicating this show to water and the effects of water. But before we get into the show, I'm going to take time to do a couple quick announcements. On July 27th at 7 o'clock, that's a Thursday, it's a week from tomorrow, the 1912 building, Palouse Group Sierra Club and Friends of the Clearwater are hosting a meeting about the Idaho Panhandle National Forest Plan revision. The district ranger from the St. Joe Ranger District will be down, so you can ask some hard questions. The comments are due on that plan on August 10th, and if you want more information, at www.wildrockies.org/FOC at Friends of the Clearwater website, there will be an alert on who and where to write to protect areas like Grandmother Mountain, Mallard Larkins, and some of the other spectacular regions in that southern end of the panhandle that bleed into the wild Clearwater country. The little north fork of the Clearwater is headwaters around the Panhandle National Forest. So with that, I'm going to take a quick musical break, and then we'll get into our show this week with Bill Bonney and water issues here on the Palouse.
Franz Svensson was a farmer. He grew the Minnesota wheat. He rode there with his daughter, high upon the thresher's seat. They broke down on the hillside, the radiator spitting steam. Went back to get the toolbox so they could fix the old machine. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, we can fix the tractor, we can make it like new. But that day they got a letter that said the power lines would come right across their farmland, right across the setting sun. So they gathered all the family and talked late into the night. We cannot let them do this. We've got to put up one hell of a fight. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, we'll apply a little pressure and we'll see what that will do. So they phoned 100 farmers and drove to the Twin Cities. Met there with the governor and they sued the utility. But after writing all the letters and paying all the legal costs to the power of the city, once again the farmers lost. And in the still of the evening, the wind is all you hear. I watch the waves on the wheat fields alone. I walk the furrows of earth I plant year after year. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. So they met there at the tavern, but there wasn't much to say. The power lines may come, but they will not stay. With the turn of the wrench and the twist of the screw, what was once put together, we can easily undo. With bandanas on their faces, careful not to make a sound, He loosened all the bolts that held the towers to the ground. And several weeks later, with nobody around, the Minnesota wind blew tower after tower after tower down with a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw. What was once stuck together, we can easily undo. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw. What was once stuck together, we can easily undo. And in the still of the evening, the wind is all you hear. I watch the waves on the alone. I walk the furrows of earth I plant year after year. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. Our land, this is our home.
Wild Clearwater Country Show. I'm going to jump into the weather and get right into the show. Looks like tonight, partly cloudy, mostly sunny tomorrow, highs around 90. Oh boy, I don't like the temperature for this weekend. Oh my, it says Friday is going to be 100 and Saturday 102 here up on the prairie, which is a very rare event that we hit 100 degrees. And same with Sunday and Monday. Yuck. Well, right now, the humidity is about 16%. It's calm. Barometer about 30 inches. And dew point, 35 degrees. So that's the weather forecast. It does not look like much chance of a rain, although it's being partly cloudy tonight. I certainly hope those hot temperatures don't come. So we've got Bill Bonney here in the studio with us. And talking a little bit about water. There's a big water issue going on here north of town on Naylor, proposal by Naylor Farm. So you want to sort of introduce a topic for us, Bill, and look at water maybe from a bigger picture perspective. Fresh water is quite an issue, and it will become one, I think, even more one in the future.
Yeah, I'd like to mention whatever sources I've been using first. There's a couple of books out there that people, I think, really would do well to consult. One's called Blue Gold by Maud Barlow. Another's called Life's Matrix, A Biography of Water by Philip Ball, who really is pretty much apolitical. He's an editor of Nature magazine, one of the more high intellectual science journals. Another is Water Wars by Diane Ward. A lot of the information I've got I derived from these sources. Generally, I think the point would be useful to make that, as ever, the ripoff business community is on top of things that the general public seems to have little or no clue about. Specifically, in May 2000, Fortune magazine had a special feature on the global water industry, which translates into corporate seizure of control of fresh water for profit. And in Fortune magazine 2000, quotation runs, quote, "Water promises to be to the 21st century what oil was to the 20th century, the precious commodity that determines the wealth of nations." In 1998, the World Bank predicted the global trade in water would be, by 2001, $1 trillion U.S. dollars. One more detail, not to be tedious. Again, the year 2000 seems to be a turning point. In March 2000, the World Water Forum, sounds good, but it's corporate control, met in The Hague, convened by big business lobby organizations, and the discussion focused on how companies could benefit from selling water to markets around the world. Over 140 governments were represented, but of course they were not in charge. And the debate, interestingly enough, was over whether water should be designated a need or a right. If water were officially designated a need, then the private sector would have the right to provide water to the general public for profit. But on the other hand, if water were designated a right of human beings, presumably the corporate sector would not have quite so much control over seizing and providing water for profit. Now, like I said, the year 2000 seems to be a turning point, and what's specifically troubling me is that you've got various kinds of absentee investment capital with an eye on this part of the country, putting forth projects that, whatever they may be, always seem to center upon access to water. The nature of the projects vary, but the ultimate enablement remains consistent, access to water. And most recently I heard a desire to draw approximately 1 million gallons a day out of the local aquifer just north of town. Well, that simply can't work, you know, regardless of whether political privileges are granted in words on paper. This kind of draw is going to affect the immediate area as well as a very widespread area. So that's partly my concern for being here this evening.
Well, good. That's, I think, a good summary of the water issue. I remember, Bill, it's been only, a few years when Bechtel Corporation tried to privatize the water in Bolivia, and that created a firestorm of protest and perhaps led to the election of Evo Morales in Bolivia. I remember as a kid, water was something you could drink in drinking fountains, and now we sell it in plastic containers in stores. When will air be next, and it will become a quote need rather than a right for people? And then already we're in some very polluted areas. They have a little pay for air stations, is it in Tokyo, as I understand, and that's been. They've had that for quite some time. So this represents, I think, a major threat to not only the stability, political stability of the world, but it's a threat to the non-human nature. Everything else that's alive and needs water out there, everything from fish to every life form that we know requires water. And I look at some of these proposals that we're seeing, and they seem to be rather audacious, I think, in their scope.
Indeed, I have to laugh at your remark about selling water, because that's virtually a quotation from The Grapes of Wrath. In exasperation at one point, Pa Jode says, next thing you know, they're going to sell us a tank of air. And in those years, it was a hyperbole, but it's coming true.
Oh, yeah. My, how times have changed. It's frightening to think about that. So, Bill, I was wondering, you talked a little bit about some of the larger context for water, and it's going to be a very, very scarce resource. worldwide, and we've already seen proposals in the past that were written off as crazy. I don't think they're so crazy now, given the current political climate. What used to go for crazy now is considered common sense, unfortunately. And that is things like diverting the Yukon River. I remember that was one. Bring it down to the lower 48 so we can have it. Certainly, transbasin water diversions have been one of the major problems and disastrous here in the West in particular. And we may see more of those ideas come. But a million gallons a day is a considerable amount of water. And I think that would have a considerable draw. I'm not sure what a city like Moscow uses, but if you figure Moscow's got 20,000 people in it, and the average person uses, I don't know, a few hundred gallons a day, that's probably even, you know, even if it's 200 or, well, even if it's 500, what is it, 50 gallons a day, whatever, it's still going to be more, that's going to be as much, just about as much as Moscow uses. I'm trying to do some math here in my head. Yeah, that's a lot of water.
And the situation is largely unspecified as yet, even in basic scientific terms. The hydrogeologic analysis of the local aquifers has yet to be completed. So it beats me on what pretense local zoning characters even make a decision to entertain proposals, much less presume to evaluate them when there's not relatively final hard data with regard to the structure and capacity of the local aquifers and what consequences might result from drawing such massive amounts of water, of all things, for all reasons, private absentee profit, sucking the water out of the ground from the entire valley here so somebody can make a little more money who's going to be located a long way away. That's, of course, the typical history of land use in America, I realize. But this simply can't go on. The concept of growth, as I remark often, I note the co-optation of biological words by the business characters. When you talk about the economy growing, simply translate that into the ecosphere dying. The economy doesn't grow, the numbers just change, and the stock portfolios of a relatively few people. The United Nations has stated that, quote, by 2025, the world will contain 2.6 billion more people than it contains now, and demand for water will exceed availability by 56%. That's not far away.
That's a frightening statistic right there. One of the questions I wanted to ask you, Bill, was we talked about local aquifers. Can you explain sort of the situation here and what some of the data may reflect about those aquifers? It's my understanding that at least locally here in the Palouse, although we think we have a different aquifer once we just drive up over the hill east of town by the golf course and enter the Clearwater drainage where I happen to live, slightly different. But here in the Palouse and around Moscow, there's a couple of aquifers, a deep water one, and which is basically prehistoric water, and we don't know how that recharges, or I'm not even sure if we know if it does recharge, versus the more shallow aquifer.
Yeah, the Wanapum is the more shallow. And, of course, I'm speaking as a relative novice here. I'm kind of a new kid on the block. I got tangled up in this out of a sense of anger and even outrage at the proposal to suck the place dry. The Wanapum aquifer is the uppermost, and it recharges apparently from meltwater and rainwater runoff. How fast it recharges is apparently not known yet from what I could find, and it is in decline. That's why the hydrogeologic analysis that I looked up was done, and it's not completed, as I said. The deeper aquifer is the Grand Ronde, and as Gary just said, it's not known whether it recharges, but it too is in decline. So you've got aquifers that involve the entire Idaho territory as well as parts of other states, both of which are in decline. And corporate profiteers want to move in and suck out millions of gallons a week. Again, it seems to me to be an issue that concerns the entire community. It's an unsustainable project, even, it seems to me, in a short-term sense. But the problem is, of course, once these limited liability corporations get political permission to do what they perhaps have specified rather specifically what they want to do, after the business gets cranked up, there's virtually no monitoring, there's virtually no legal recourse, so they do what they please. And the objects of the verb do is going to be you and me.
I think that's right. It might be interesting to explore quickly, Bill, the concept of a limited liability. As I recall, it was the Supreme Court back in the late 1800s, and it was in the Plessy versus Ferguson famous lawsuit, determined that corporations are persons and have constitutional rights. But if you have limited liability, it's like you have none of the obligations of a person, but you have all of the rights of citizenship, with, I guess, one exception, and that's really an unimportant one in terms for the corporations, and that's the right to vote separately from the individuals that have formed said corporation. But I was wondering, what is limited liability and how does that work? Do you know much about
that? Not able to quote specific laws, but it seems to me that it's a legal fiction that's been invented to enable certain profiteers to evade obligations to the community with regard to assuming responsibility for the consequences of their profit-grinding activities. It's pretty simple, the concept. It's a concept that evades people to privatize profit and socialize the consequences. We live with horror of the word socialism in this country, but it's quite obvious that for investment capitalists, it's socialism. For the schmucks like me with a very small bank account and a Visa card, it's hard-nosed capitalism, by cracky.
that's right.
But the pretense that not only is a legal fiction like a corporation a human being, but that somehow they're also immortal. I mean, you've got this medieval transcendentalist vocabulary that's plugged into contemporary law. Nothing makes me laugh more than business people who presume to be, by God, hard-nosed, bottom-line people as if they have reality at their fingertips. They live in a world of late medieval transcendentalist rhetoric. It's virtually nonsense, but of course it's on the books and gets enforced by military power, so it's something we're all compelled to at least obey, if not respect. But the idea that something's immortal until it decides to phase itself out of existence, then all of a sudden it doesn't exist anymore at all, which it does to evade responsibility for what it's done materially in the physical world, or that, as I said, a legal fiction can be somehow treated as a human being, which means that real human beings get the shaft.
Yes, and in fact, I think this radio station has publicized a show that was at the Kenworthy about a year ago called The Corporation. And as I recall, the premise of the show was that if one were to psychoanalyze a corporation, it would be found to be antisocial, schizophrenic, and a danger and menace to society. Therefore, something needs to happen. It needs to be locked up. And there have been some other people have talked about a death penalty for corporations, as it were, ending them when they do things that are a menace or a danger to society. And in theory, corporations are supposed to serve society, and that's why they're founded in the first place. So all of this is relevant, I guess, to the issue here in Latah County and in Moscow about water development and in all the land use issues that we face, particularly in an increasingly global world where water being very scarce, whoever holds the water sort of holds the power in any given community. And the situation in North Idaho, I think, is rapidly changing. it's rather unique for the West. There are a few areas, Pacific Northwest being the only one I can think of, where water quality rather than quantity has been the limiting factor in the past. Of course, we all know all about Silver Valley and the problems with the heavy metals and whatnot up there, and certain issues on agriculture, agricultural chemicals, and agricultural practices changing water quality here on the Palouse. Concern over, of course, Paradise Creek and whatnot. But here in the future, rapidly, I think water quantity will also be an issue here for North Idaho, especially in a global world. The statistic you quoted, 56% more demand, as it were, more need for water than there is currently, than there is fresh water on the planet, I guess.
At least accessible fresh water.
Right.
Yeah, Wallace Stegner made the comment that, quote, water is the true wealth. Without it, land is virtually worthless. And if you control the water, you control the land that depends on it. I think it's interesting that, of course, the investment capitalists already have control of the land, but that's not good enough for them. They got to have the water. And that virtually demonstrates the validity of what Stegner said back in 1954, to work the land, not just agriculturally, but just to grind it up and sell it off as this profit-grinding project for clay and gravel out in the valley is conceived. They still got to have lots and lots of water to do that. So the water is absolutely crucial, not just for life, it seems, but for even the grossest industrial processing.
I want to shift gears here a little bit, Bill, and I'll kind of bring it back to sort of what's happened to history here. My understanding was the county commission here in Latah County basically said no to an earlier process. And Naylor Farms or whoever representing that interest out there took it to court. And the court decided, I think based on what one would call a technicality, that the county didn't have jurisdiction over water. That was a state issue. Therefore, the decision that was made concerning the area, since it was based upon water, was sort of out of bounds for the county. And so they had to go back, and now the process has started all over again. Is that sort of your understanding of what's happened legally?
Yes, to the best of my knowledge, that's the understanding. And again, it seems to me perhaps appropriate from one point of view, but from another point of view, where the well is situated that's sucking the aquifer dry, it seems to me, is also of fundamental importance, and that is a local issue. The well that's sucking the aquifer dry is not some nebulous thing that includes the whole state.
I think that's you bring about an important distinction, because water development has impacts on the surface of the land, which then becomes a county issue. And a well site is a development, and an infrastructure, and certainly a gravel pit, which and a clay mining operation, which has been requested up there, would not only use a lot of water, which is what we're discussing here, but is under the direct jurisdiction of Latah County.
Yes, again, it's a very specific and dramatic change in the structure of the aquifer and the flow through in the aquifer, and it's not something, as I said, that's nebulous and somehow vaguely includes the whole state. It's going to be because of a very specific operation with very specific wells dug for very specific reasons to suck the water out. So it seems to me it's an issue that quite legitimately the local community can and needs to focus upon.
All right. I think maybe we can take a little musical break here, and we'll come back and discuss a little bit more about water in the Palouse and some of the concerns and some of the proposals here locally. So I think a couple of Joan Baez tunes that, in fact, one is a Bob Dylan tune that got keyed up here, and we'll be back. You're listening to the Wild Clearwater Country Show, KRFP Moscow.
Where have you been, my blue-eyed son? Where have you been, my darling young one? I've stumbled on the side of 12 misty mountains. I've walked and I've crawled crooked highways. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, it's a hard. What did you see, my blue-eyed son? What did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn babe with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. And it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard. It's a hard rains are gonna fall. What did you hear, my blue-eyed son? What did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole. Whose hands were blazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve. I heard many people laughing. And it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard. It's a hard. Are gonna fall. What'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? What'll you do now, my darling young one? Well, we're going back out before the rain starts falling. Of the deepest dark forest. Oh, the people are many, but the hands are all empty. Oh, the bellies are poison, they are filling their waters. Oh, the home in the valley meets a damp, dirty prison. Executioner's face, it is always well hidden. Black is the color, and the nun is the number. And I'll tell it, and I'll think it, and I'll speak it, and I'll breathe it. And reflect from the mountains, so that our souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean until I start sinking. Ah, oh, but I'll know my song well before I start singing. Oh, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, and it's hard, it's hard, it's hard. I gotta
That was Joan Baez channeling Bob Dylan there a little bit. And we're back, the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Been talking about water. And Bill, you made a couple of interesting points, sort of on the global perspective of water and how certain events that are happening right now really have water at the base of it. So why don't you just take it away?
Well, just a few details again. And again, I'm obliged to tell you where I got this stuff. It's from Philip Ball's book, Life's Matrix, A Biography of Water. Again, he's an editor of Nature Journal, a hard science journal. He's got, as far as I can tell, no particular political axe to grind. I was in graduate school when the early Arab-Israeli conflict developed in the late 60s and was blundering around writing term papers and not informed at all. But I was rather amazed to find out that apparently what sparked the early Arab-Israeli conflict in the late 60s was water. There was an attempt to do some construction of dams across the Jordan River, which Israel found objectionable and simply blew them up. And this was back in 1964, which developed then into the Six-Day War of 1967, resulting in Israel occupying the Golan Heights in Syria, which gave them command over local water over the Jordan River. Given the evening news nowadays, of course, what you get is the usual mystification, the ongoing pretense that it's metaphysics, of course, that causes this and causes that, and not the material facts of the way people live. A couple more details might be interesting. Today, Palestinian Arabs consume 7 times less water than Jewish Israelis. On the West Bank, 1.2 million Palestinians have access to only 1/4 of the local aquifer, whereas the other 3/4 goes to 100,000 Israelis. No wonder people are annoyed, to put it mildly. And again, this gets no publicity over common news media. The whole thing has turned into some sort of vaguely incomprehensible metaphysical conflict. But to some extent, of course, it may be reduced to that in the minds of certain of the combatants, but there's got to be a material basis for the conflict. Otherwise, the metaphysical spark, it seems to me, would hardly be there.
Bill, I think that's a great example of what we've been talking about, water, one that we can look at from afar and see the consequences of the industrialization, the rampant growth, the 6.5 billion of us and counting, the impacts that we are having on this planet in terms of fresh water. And I guess it's no secret that there are reasons for wars, and the term quote unquote resources tends to be lying at the bedrock reason for those. And as you pointed out, there may be all sorts of metaphysical and ideological and other sorts of justifications and or reasons put forth. But when you cut through all of the outlying debris, it seems to be down there, there's that scarcity, resource wars, and water. In fact, as you mentioned earlier, water will be to the 21st century what oil was to the last century. You were mentioning, too, also some of the history of corporations and how they influence water politics and how we got to, at least in this country, where we are today.
Well, the 14th Amendment always makes me chuckle, because in the 14th Amendment, the sacred phrase, which our politicians know, no pause in repeating to us, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that phrase, which sounds very good, of course, gets changed to, quote, life, liberty, or property. And it's the 14th Amendment, which apparently was seized on in the 1880s by courts to ultimately interpret so as to give corporations the right of being persons. Presumably, again, from what I've read in history books, the 14th Amendment was conceived initially to protect the rights of black people. But between 1890 and 1910, only 19 Supreme Court decisions concerning the 14th Amendment dealt with black people, 288 dealt with corporations. So the 14th Amendment was instantly co-opted by corporate interests, and it has been largely functioning that way ever since.
Wow, that's an amazing statistic there. One of the interesting things and one of the controversies here, of course, revolves around the mining, the potential mining of clay, sand and gravel, et cetera, out there. I guess mainly gravel and clay out north of town. It seems though there's quite a bit of gravel here in the county. There doesn't seem to be any shortage, really any need for that. And on the issue of clay, that's been an ongoing one. There's been several issues about kaolinite clay, and it's used in, has many industrial processes, although it's in many industrial uses for several industrial processes, although it is not in and of itself a rare material. It is widely used. It coats paper. I think it's used as a filler for medications like aspirins and whatnot. But in by no means is it rare. And several years ago, there was a proposal to operate a clay mine out by Deary on state land, and that ran, of course, to a lot of local opposition. And it's my understanding that the interests, they were venture capitalists that were promoting that mine, were from Vancouver. Is there a connection? I believe there's some of the same interests that were also had an interest in the situation up here with the idea of clay mining there.
I can only say what I've heard, and that may or may not be finally valid, that at least one individual who's got a major interest in this clay and gravel operation is connected also with a group in Vancouver called iMinerals. I guess they're peddling stock on the internet, from what I've been told, but that's about all I can say.
It would seem that there, you know, early on when this proposal came about, there seemed to be some connection a few years ago between the different interests and deciding where the clay mine would be. Originally, like I said, there was an idea they wanted to put a clay mine in near Deary. Now they're talking about one north of town. I'm not sure how serious those threats are or how real they are. I think we have to look at them as such. But a lot of speculation is part of the current economic process that we all go through. And I guess it's a way to make money and bucks. And so, unfortunately, the local citizens have to put up with all sorts of moneyed schemes on issues that are really important locally, and the money isn't necessarily even local. The capital can come from just about anywhere.
Exactly. It's absentee profiteering. And, of course, as is typical under the present economic totalitarianism, if the investors actually had to pay for what they're doing, there's no way they could turn a profit. The only way anything like this can show a profit is if very narrow definitions are used, profit again privatized, and the area north of Moscow, a major part of Latah County, gets to swallow the damage, whether it's noise, whether it's increased traffic on 95, whether it's diesel exhaust and interminable backup beepers in the air, whether, of course, the aquifer gets sucked dry. Limited Liability Corporation, they turn a profit, everybody else takes a hit. It's a fantasy. It's a legal fiction. It's nonsense, but again, militarily defended. So that's where we are.
Okay, Bill. I think we'll take another quick music break and then come back and sort of wrap the show up and go into at the top of the hour KRFP's weekly news program, Between the Lines. So here we go. I think you chose some more Joan Baez for us. This is a song about somebody that I know a little bit about. He was executed in the state that I was born and raised in. He said he didn't want to be caught dead in Utah, and his ashes were scattered everywhere else. A famous union leader. I remember we had a big celebration on the site of his execution. It is now a city park, the site of the old Utah State Prison and Sugar House in Salt Lake City. And that's Joe Hill, the famous wobbly songwriter and singer from and who was executed in 1915 by legally sanctioned murder by the state of Utah. So here's a song about Joe Hill. I believe that was written by Robinson, as I recall. In fact, he was at that celebration. He was killed after that. He was in his 80s in an unfortunate, tragic automobile accident in Seattle. I'm trying to remember my name's here, but a song about Joe Hill. So here we go, Joan Baez.
Sing this one for Michael Moore. I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you or me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. Oh, the copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. It takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe. I didn't die, says Joe. I didn't die. And standing there, as big as life, and
back to the Wild Clearwater Country Show, and I think we'll kind of wrap it up here. Bill, do you have any sort of last things to say?
I'd like to read a quotation from an international marketer of water called Global H2O. I think the remark they made is quite revealing of what's in store. Quote, water has moved from being an endless commodity that may be taken for granted to a ration necessity that may be taken by force. I think that's what's in store for many parts of the world. And one comment remaining for me is, I used to live in Fairbanks, Alaska, where water is indeed scarce. Now, that's fresh water that can be put in your body. There's lots of glacier flour around and water that's the color of apple cider from iron. But in Alaska, when I lived there in the 60s and 70s, it's not uncommon in Fairbanks to buy a 1,200-gallon tank, have a special room built on the side of your house, and get water tanked to your house by truck. This, indeed, is, it seems to me, the ultimate answer to the man's fantasies. Pump the ground dry, have everything so screwed up that everybody has to go to the man for a drink. We're blessed here in North Idaho with what seems to be an abundance of water, but I think it's also right on the edge of becoming something that we need seriously to take into account. That's all I've got to say tonight.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah. And we will keep you updated on the show when different decisions and public meetings are set for this issue. Again, the aquifer issue is quite important. There are several organizations. The Pluse Water Conservation Network is one that you can look up on the web and to discuss this issue about water here on the Palouse. And I think I'll go to a PSA now, and we'll conclude the Wild Clearwater Country Show. Join us next week. I think Will be back from vacation, and we will reinstitute, of course, the Whopper of the Week. A couple of ongoing events. Monday night's Latin dance class at the Attic, 314 East 2nd Street. Starts at 6:45 p.m., and newcomers are welcome. Contact Mike Bradley for more information. EagleBradley@yahoo.com. And Friday night's International Folk Dance Group in the Attic, 314 East 2nd Street in Moscow, about 7:45 p.m. Teaching for the first hour, newcomers welcome. All this is brought to you by the local organization, the Palouse Folklore Society, who sponsors several folk concerts and traditional dance concerts. So now it's time for Between the Lines. You are listening to KRFP Moscow, Idaho, home to Moscow's community radio station.